Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of NatureNow at kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Bob Friel. Bob is with the SeaDoc Society, where he's the producer and filmer of a series of videos called Salish Sea Wild. Now, I first learned about Bob from a conversation with Joe Gatos, who's also with the SeaDoc Society. And some listeners may remember that I interviewed Joe back in spring of 2015 when his book, The Salish Sea, Jewel of the Pacific Northwest, was first published. And then I spoke to him again in 2018 with the publication of a companion book meant for children called Learning About the Salish Sea for Kids. Anyway, the SeaDoc Society, I need to share just a little bit about it. It's a very small group. It's sponsored by the University of California, Davis, and its offices are located on Orcas Island. Perhaps the thing I like best about the SeaDoc Society is they do wonderful things, and they are a great spokesman for the sea around us and the creatures that live in it. Their tagline is People and Science, Healing the Salish Sea. And as a member of what they call Team SeaDoc, Bob is a filmmaker, writer, naturalist, adventurer, as well as the producer, editor, and filmer of Salish Sea Wild. Part one of our conversation, we aired back the first week of July, I think it was July 4th, and we're back with part two. But before we get to that, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Well, a little hint. When I first spotted one of these critters, I turned to the expert naturalist who was out on the outing with us, and I asked what I should be looking for to confirm its identity. He looked at me rather oddly and told me, would I just look carefully? Well, I did, and it was off. We'll tell you what you just heard towards the end of the show. But first, let's go to that conversation with Bob Friel. Bob, can you tell me a story of one of your favorite adventures?
Last episode, I did tease the giant Pacific octopus. So let me start with
okay.
That. Yeah, that's always a crowd pleaser. And that's, again, something that I had heard of from the time I started diving when I was 12 years old. And took me a long time, decades, to actually get out in the water with one. Joe and I went with Florian Groner, who you're...
I talked to Florian several years ago when he was here working with the Marine Science Center.
Yeah. Florian's a great guy, an awesome diver, a good friend of SeaDoc, and a dive buddy of ours. So we enlisted him as a diver, and he's an amazing cinematographer. So he brought his big cameras out there, and we were in Hood Canal, in the middle of the night, which of course is the perfect setting if you're going to see a giant sea monster. And everything was just, you know, perfect. It was dark. And if you look at the episode, I think it's called Shaking Hands with the World's Biggest Octopus. And it is the world's biggest octopus. They grow over 100 pounds, 15 feet long. Amazing. And just like the other octopus that I've known, I mean, when I had started, you know, seeing octopus and experiencing them, encountering them before, I was always fascinated with the chromatophores in them, and they can change will, change texture. And I have never met an octopus that wasn't so curious. I mean, it seems too curious for their own good. But if you're underwater with one and you approach gently and you're, you know, a decent diver, you're not crashing around down there, but you just kind of come up calmly to one, stick your hand out there and wait. You can just see the octopus going, oh, I really want to reach out. I really want to reach out. And I've seen dozens and dozens and dozens. And I think every one of them, except for one or two, have done that. And so, of course, I was hoping that this giant octopus would do the same thing. And it did. And again, the setting is pitch black darkness. It's under a cave in its beautiful den. Just a gorgeous, gorgeous animal. And the same exact thing, even though this was I think Florian judged it at 80 pounds and 12 feet long or whatever, it still did the same thing. And then a little harder reaching on with the suckers, and just a wonderful experience. And you know, that's, to me, that's one of the best things about the show, is getting to do things like this. And it's kind of forcing you. I mean, all of these things are right here in our backyard. You know, there's sometimes can even see octopus when you're snorkeling around here. We even did a show. We know kind of a big entry level for people in this kind of chilly water, and it looks pretty green, a little dark, a little scary sometimes, but it's really not. And so even people who just get a wetsuit and a mask and fins can go down there and just see amazing things, and to hold your breath and go down just being at the surface. So that's another thing that we like to do with the show, is bring people things that they don't see normally, but maybe inspires them to get out more, to get in the water more.
I'm jealous. So let's see, let's try another one. Let's try a story where you were just sort of completely surprised by what happened during the filming, or something really unexpected happened.
You know, one of the coolest ones, it's the episode, we have it listed up there. I think it's called Destruction Island Director's Cut or something like that. We ran into COVID deadlines and things, and I wound up putting the episode out without a full soundscape like I normally do, with music and ambient sound that I recorded there. So it's hard for me to look, because there's some glaring things, like not enough sound covering dead space. But that was probably one of the coolest trips I've ever done. And this was just at the edge of, you know, the Salish Sea, where it dumps out into the Pacific, an island called Destruction Island that is a preserve that was run by the state. Now it's been turned over by the feds. So you're not supposed to go out there. It's a nature preserve, but we're out there with scientists from the state, from local universities. And we went out there to look at tufted puffins and do research, having an issue with their population as well. Their population is really declining in the Salish Sea. So we went out there, and you have to camp. And we showed up, we brought a Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife boat out there, then got into a little inflatable, cruised up to the beach where we were gonna set up camp. And there was a little bit of a smell, and we went where everybody was setting up the kitchen that we were gonna use for the 3 or 4 days that we were out there. And just on the other side was not one, but two dead gray whales that had stranded. One was totally skeletal, so there were the big bones. And then another one was, you know, Joe and I are part of the Marine Mammal Stranding Network and the Whale Entanglement Response Team as well. So we rate dead things as dead, stinky, fresh, dead, things like that. This was getting pretty dead, stinky. But that was the only place we could camp, so we didn't bother the birds, the puffins, on the other side of the island. And then how we ran that trip, you know, we camped there on the beach, and where we were, there were rhinoceros auklets that were nesting in a hillside above where we were camped. Mm-hmm. We knew I think we had a 3 o'clock, 3 a.m. wake up call in order to then trudge, grab all of our gear, including a temporary veterinary station, all of our tagging gear, all of my camera gear. And there, it's basically rock climbing on these slick rocks, the entire thing. So we would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and just go by headlamp, clambering over these slick rocks, climbing up 20-foot walls and down. And we were amazed the entire time that no one got hurt until the last day, when one of the scientists broke his leg and had to get helicoptered off. So a little surprise. But during the night, in the short time we had to sleep, we wound up not being able to sleep, because above our heads, the rhinoceros auklets, and their anti-predator strategy is to come back to the nests at night. So eagles around and other raptors around. So they come back at night and their nests are in the hillside behind a whole copse of trees. So they would come in and they're another alcid. So it's a big football sized bird,
yeah,
with tiny little wings. So they just flap the wings a million miles an hour and they make sound as they fly because they're flapping so hard. And they come in with this kind of whistling sound right over the top of our camp. And then they just crash into the trees. I mean, it's a very ungainly bird, like a puffin as well. So all night long, you're hearing this, and then crash.
Oh, weird.
As they would then go into their nests. And so, you know, by the third day, we're all kind of hallucinating because we've had no sleep and we're still having to climb over the rocks. And we went out to the puff. And it's just an amazing, it was kind of, I kind of termed it as our Galapagos Island out here. Because sea otters out there, all of them had pups. There were, you know, seal. It was almost as if, even though humans have been out there, there's an old lighthouse that's out there. And there's rabbits out there, which is one of the biggest conservation issues. Mm-hmm. They were introduced, and now they're causing the land to kind of collapse, and they're hurting the seabird nests. But it was almost like you were in an untouched place, seeing things out there.
Exciting. Okay, let me try another one with you. You sort of mentioned some of the physical trials there. How about a story around a really dangerous experience, either for you or for the animals you were filming? And maybe if dangerous doesn't trigger, maybe the most adventurous episode.
I'll say this for UC Davis insurance purposes, everything is safe at all times. And we actually do one of the great things about CDOC being part of UC Davis is that we really have a wonderful dive safety officer and boating safety officer, that comes up and we go through lots of training every year. But some things are just kind of inherently dangerous when you're doing field work. And this was another time. It was another night operation. It was actually another seabird operation. So, you know, we're capturing some animals when it's necessary in order to, you know, when you've got populations going down and there's some things like the tufted puffins, we have this entire part of their whole annual cycle, we have a big question mark. You know, we're wondering, the population is crashing here. Is it because of forage fish? Is it because of this? Because of pteropods, you know, affecting the forage fish? Is it because of the eagles? So there's some basic questions we have to ask about these things. And, you know, wanting to capture an animal and put it through any kind of stress is the last thing you want to do. But sometimes in conservation science, that's, you have to do.
You have to, because the information is really important. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, we've done that, you know, and it makes naturally for a kind of a cool episode because you're very up close with the animal at that point. So we were doing that one time to capture seabirds and put tags on them. And this was done from boat. So we're in little 10-foot inflatables in the middle of the night in kind of big swells. And we also had, it was during a heat wave. So we had the cool water and we had the warm air. So not only was it really dark, but there was a thick sea fog. And, you know, we're in a 10-foot boat. And if you were back at the engine, you could barely see the person at the front who was holding the spotlight looking for the birds. And we're going around in the little thing, looking with spotlights on the ground, trying to pierce through the fog. And it was so disorienting. You know, you could feel these big swells as they were just about to crash on the rocks. And we were kind of navigating by feeling how big the swells would get, because they would get bigger as they got to the rock. Mm-hmm. You're trying to listen to the sound of it crashing on the rock. And then you would just go the opposite direction until you heard swells hitting another rock. And in between, you're trying to find these seabirds. But it was so disorienting that in the spotlight, you would see some, oh, there's a bird. So we would speed up and then someone on the front would have a net. And it would turn out to be just a feather or just a little bit of sea foam. But because you had no reference for the things looking in that spotlight. So at one point, one of the gals who worked for Fish and Wildlife, who was driving at the time, she just, you know, she's like, I have to stop. I'm starting, you know, people were, you know, you were starting to feel really uneasy about the whole situation. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, let's just shut off the engine. We'll just all relax. We'll all just kind of lie back on the, again, this is 4 o'clock in the morning, totally pitch black. It also happened to be the height of one of the meteor showers. So when the sea fog was so low that we could look straight up through a hole in the fog and watch shooting stars go by. And then stellar sea lions, curious marine mammals, came out and started circling and splashing.
Right. Well, who are you? Yes.
Well, they're shooting up all this bioluminescence in the water. So we've got shooting stars above us. We got shooting stars in the water from sea lions, and we're in this fog, and it was realistically dangerous, but it was also one of the most magical times I've had.
Magical is the word that occurred to me. It's like, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the animals, you know, a stellar sea lion could easily take you out. But as you saw in that episode, and there were also some outtakes to that we didn't show, there was a stellar sea lion, you know, about 600 pounds, who either fell in love with me and wanted me to stay down there and in his or her octopus's garden and eat herring, you know, all day.
But it was right.
He or she would not let me get back to the boat. As Joe and I were heading back to the boat, this sea lion, three times as large as I am or heavy as I am, decided that it was going to pin me to the bottom and keep me from getting back to the boat.
Wow.
Presumably, over the years, I've had dolphins do the similar kind of thing when you have a great moment with this animal and they're curious and you're a new plaything. And they're like, well, no, you're going to stay in the water. I've had dolphins grab me by the fins and pull me off a ladder of a dive boat before in Belize. And this animal was kind of doing the same thing. So at the same time, I was holding a camera out and Joe Gatos was there with a GoPro filming the entire thing as I was kind of getting beaten by this. You know, they kind of look squishy, but their flippers feel like a baseball bat or a concrete or a metal bar wrapped together. So it was spinning around on top of me, hold me on the bottom and kept, you know, smacking me in the head with its flipper. And then it finally slapped the camera. So I had to that's the only time I kind of reached out to it, and that made it more excited. So it would then go up to the surface for a breath, and I would go probably another 30, 40 feet towards the boat, and then it would come flying down to the bottom again. And, you know, we were starting to look at our air, and Joe always breathes his air faster than me. So I'm down there under a 600-pound sea lion, and he's showing me his pressure gauge saying, well, I don't know what you're doing, but I'm going to head back to the boat.
Uh-huh. Right. Thanks. Yeah.
And so finally, on the fourth time, it went up and I just shot to the boat. It could have done damage. I mean, they've got a grizzly bear, but it just decided it had a new plaything. That's what our interpretation means.
You know, you mentioned grizzlies in that program on the stellar sea lions. I had never thought about comparing them to grizzlies. And then the information, the shots you provided of the skulls and the comparative qualities of those two animals, I found fascinating. I just had never thought about that they are the grizzlies of the sea, perhaps, and even more.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're larger than they are. And when you look at that shot, I was able to go down to the museum at UW, and they're kind enough to let me get in there and play with the skulls. So we were able to put them one against the other. And, you know, for a relatively similar aged animal, the stellar sea lion skull and teeth were larger than the grizzly. So it's really an amazing animal.
Bob, your stories are great. One of the questions I was going to ask is, tell us a story of an awesome occurrence. And however you've defined awesome, your stories have already been pretty awesome. And the notion of the bioluminescence below and the meteor showers above with a layer of fog at the water surface, you know, it just, as you said, it sounds magical. I did also want to ask you, there was one of the episodes that dealt with the problem of entanglement on some of the large whales. I wondered if you could just sort of give a little background on that story.
Yeah, like I said, Joe Gatos and I were part of the founding group of the Large Whale Entanglement Response Network out here in the San Juans. And there are other people like John Kalamakidis and the guys down at Cascadia who are higher level entanglement responders than we are. Yeah, entanglement is, you know, in that episode, you know, we tell the story about the, you know, it's kind of similar to the eagles. It's the recovery of the great whale. And again, that was a relatively simple thing. You just have to stop killing them, stop harpooning them, stop sticking explosives in them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the whales are able to now respond and, you know, nature, leave it alone. And most times it can come back as long as, you know, we take its our foot off its throat. So what's happening now, and this is really critical, like I've done work on the East Coast with the North Atlantic right whales, where the entanglement issue is taking them very close to extinction. There's just a few hundred animals left there, and they are tangled up in lobster and crab traps, you know, off the northern east coast of the U.S. and off of Canada there. And the same problem happens out here. And fortunately, it's not driving anything to extinction, but it's both an animal welfare issue because its entanglement is just a horrible way for these animals to die because the whales are so big and so strong, they can carry these entanglements for years. And usually the gear, you know, people tend to think of it or assume that it's kind of lost gear or lost nets, but usually what it is actively fished gear or sometimes lost, like out here, the big issue off of our coast, everywhere from California north is Dungeness crab fisheries, usually the commercial stuff. And the whales will get entangled in that. You know, a humpback has those big pectoral fins. It can wrap around the pectoral fins. It can wrap around the fluke. It can go through their mouth. And unfortunately, if it gets, you know, and the whale, once it feels that it strikes the line, they have a tendency. I've seen them. I've snorkeled with humpback whales, like off the Dominican Republic, where you see the little calves, and they seem to learn to spin. And I think my guess, educated guess, is that's a defensive maneuver. Like if an orca were to attack them, spinning, especially when you've got those big flippers, that might help you get away from an orca that's trying to bite you. So I think the whales, that's a general defensive thing. But the problem is when they hit a line and start spinning, it will wrap around them. Mm-hmm. If they can't free themselves, they'll then carry that, often with a big 60-pound trap connected to it. But they'll keep swimming, you know, the larger ones. Some of them, it will just anchor them and it can drown them. But if they keep swimming, you know, we've seen it or seen images within our network that other responders have gone to where it will literally cut the tail, cut the flukes off of a whale by the rope, you know, going, just imagine your hands being really wet and then having something abrasive on it for all that. And it's just an awful way to die. And it hurts the whale. So for that episode, we went out on an entanglement survey. We went out around Nia Bay, where there's usually in the summer, there's a big, huge gathering of humpback whales. And we've been out there in the midst of literally hundreds of humpbacks that are out there feeding. And then we just kind of pick our way through looking to see if any have been entangled. It's a big issue. We have such a large area here that by the time we get a report that a whale is entangled, you know, we have to get our, you talk about danger. That's a very dangerous activity, is disentangling a 50-foot, 40-ton whale with this giant tail, and they're in pain and they can be panicked. So we go through a ton of training, and we've got special knives, special gear, all this other kind of stuff that we use. So when we have done these surveys, we've gone out and picked our way through, usually because we've had a report that there was an entangled whale. But unless somebody stands by the whale, which is a good information for anybody out there who sees it, there's a number, SOS whale, that you can call, or you can call the local marine mammal stranding network and report a whale. If you see gear, like a trap buoy or something tangling, being dragged behind a whale, that means it's entangled. And the most important thing, if people are able to, is to stand by then and keep an eye on that whale. Because like I said, even if they're dragging a 60-pound trap, a big 50-foot humpback will just keep swimming and can swim at 5 or 6 knots. Mm-hmm. A couple hours by the time we get out there, or it may take for us to get a team together, the whale will be miles and miles away. So, yeah, it's a big issue. And what I was getting at before is that it's a ridiculous number. I think it's 40% or more of the whales show scars that have been entangled. So that means that out there right now, there are whales that are entangled dealing with this kind of issue.
Bob, this has been absolutely fascinating to listen to some of your stories, and we've run out of time. I want to thank you again for sharing your stories with us. And I want to encourage listeners to explore the Salish Sea Wild videos. You can find them a variety of ways. You can just Google Salish Sea Wild, or you can go to salishseawild.org. You can go to YouTube and search for Salish Sea Wild, or you can go to the Sea Doc Society website, which is seadocsociety.org. And there are links to the series there as well. They're fascinating and they're fun. So we just have time. Listen again to our mystery sound. Well, those odd sounds, those low nasal mooing calls, they were from the breeding grounds of the rhinoceros auklet. You know, they're sort of like barks, growls, brays, groans, a very mix of sounds. Bob talked about some of the sounds they made flying earlier in the program. And the name rhinoceros auklet, citing the Cornell Ornithology Lab, its name refers to the single vertical horn that sticks up from its orange bill, an odd accessory that turns out to be fluorescent and may be used for visual communication. So it's that horn you see, and it's like a rhinoceros. What can I say? So that's it for this episode of Nature Now. Hope you've enjoyed our program. And I want to thank not only Bob Friel, but certainly today's sound engineer and editor, Nora Petrich. Podcasts are available on the KPTZ website. Thanks for listening. Our ending music today is Out on the Ocean. It's a traditional Irish jig, and it's performed by fiddler Kevin Burke. Thanks again.
Dungeness River Nature Center is proud to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature. Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.